make it paper.
Welcome to episode 95 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm speaking with Russell Moret, a book artist and letter designer working in New York City. He began printing in San Francisco as a teenager before apprenticing with Peter Koch in Berkeley and Firefly Press in Somerville, Massachusetts. Moret set up his own press at the Center for Book Arts in New York City in 1993 and has been printing and publishing ever since. In 1996, Moret began teaching himself to design letter forms, leading to a 12-year study of letter forms before he completed his first typeface in 2008. In 2011, he began working to convert some of his type designs into new metal typefaces for letterpress printing. Since then, he has produced 4 metal typefaces and 4 suites of metal ornaments. Moret's books and manuscripts are in public and private collections throughout the world. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Russell Moret, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thanks, Helen. It's great to be here.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing your story. And let's just start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and what kind of things did you do? Did anything sort of lead you to this artistic path?
It's interesting. I grew up about 50 miles north of New York City in a tiny little town that was at the time was mainly a summer community for New Yorkers. My parents were part of the first wave of people who were willing to commute from that long a distance.
And what town?
It's called Mohegan Lake, New York. It's right near Peekskill. And at the time, it was it was a town that was, from my perspective, extremely conducive to boredom. I did not like it there, and had a very, it was a half-empty town. Had a very sort of lonely, inward childhood. And as far as looking for antecedents of how I became spent a career working with craft, there are none. I was a very unmotivated child. I was completely in my head and sort of spent my time daydreaming. But there was something that in my teens, I got it into my head that I wanted to be a poet. And that sort of led me into the book. I thought that in order to be a poet, I had to drop out of high school, which I did. And after about 6 months of working at CVS and living with my parents, rather than living in France and writing my great book, I decided to go to college. And I found a little college in San Francisco called New College of California that had no entry requirements and offered a poetics degree. And it was also a very convenient way to get my parents to pay for me to move as far away from home as I could think of.
So I want to ask you, how did you even know to look for that school? Reading a lot and doing research.
It was complete. I don't know if you remember, but back in those days, when you wanted to pick a college, they had these enormous books that were 2 telephone book thicknesses of every college in the country. And I don't know how I found it. I think I was probably looking at New School for Social Research and found New College of California and saw poetics and no entry requirements. And what it was just this sort of anarchist school that was based on the teachings of John Dewey, so it was connected to the New School of Social Research in its founding principles, but really it was just a bunch of misfits who sort of came together and started the school. And when I got there, I didn't really have any intention of attending. I just wanted to get school was never my ideal learning environment. So but when I got there, they had a bunch of posters around the building that were advertising a letterpress printing class, kind of in the vein of Marxist, you know, taking poets take control of the means of production. And I had heard about letterpress printing at some point, and I just signed up for the class, and like with all my other classes, I didn't show up. And toward the end of the semester, I had to go to the building, and it was such a small place that everybody knew each other. And I ran into the printing instructor, who just said, you know, look, I need this job. You come down and print something and give me a good review. I'll give you a good review, and we'll call it quits. And I walked in, and it was love at first sight. It was the first time I ever realized that my daydreams could produce something tactile. And by the end of the next semester, I had met Peter Koch, and I had dropped out and became an apprentice in his studio. And so it was really entirely accidental.
Wow, that's cool. So you're saying you didn't actually go to the letterpress class?
Not for the first couple of months, but once I went down there, they had to kick me out at Christmas break, and it was very rapid. And so the spring semester was the beginning of 1990. Richard Minsky was putting on this book arts conference in New York, and somehow New College got a table, and I went. And my table was next to the Dudenay table, where the new executive director, Mina Takahashi, was staffing the table. And I got to know her. And then the next month, through Peter Koch, I moved into, I rented a room and had access to the studio at the Press in Tuscany Alley, which is a sort of historic press in San Francisco. And it just sort of took off from there. Yeah, it was very fast and completely unplanned. Yeah.
And you were able to get an income?
No.
Or were your parents still supporting you? Like, how did that kind of?
I worked in a used bookstore a couple days a week, and then the apprenticeship with Peter was unpaid, but he bought me lunch. So I had a lot of one meal days, and then right around rent time, I would place desperate calls to my parents and get some money for rent. And it wasn't until about a year later that I ended up in the Boston area and got a job at Firefly Press, which was actually paid. And that began, but it took me a long time. I had very little training in how to manage my life and finances, and it took a long time before I figured that out. So I printed, and I was nothing was going to stop me from printing, but there were a lot of dicey, impoverished moments in the first decade or so of that.
I can relate to that. So what was the first thing you printed for yourself?
For myself, the first thing I printed was a book of E. Cummings poems that I just called Seven Poems. And it was a book in which I chose a different typeface for each of the poems, trying to, you know, choose some sort of form that somehow echoed or embodied the content of the poem. And I printed it, and I always hated bookbinding, and so I never I hate it considerably less now, but I still didn't have a very good work ethic, so I printed the book and never bound the copies. I only made 5 copies of it. And about a year and a half later, a book dealer in San Francisco somehow heard that I had printed this, and convinced me to sew them together and in the for the promise of some money, and which I did. And so that was really the first book that I made on my own. I was working on books in class and then with Peter in his studio, but so that was strangely, you know, I've spent most of my career trying to draw links between letter forms and textual content, and that was sort of an early example of that, I guess.
Right. And yeah, tell me a little bit more about your interest in letter forms. Did that come from the type that you saw that you were using for letterpress? Or,
well, yeah, I mean, I had the good fortune of studying with printers who really had a deep knowledge of the history of type. And so I got a very thorough education in the history of type forms and in the sort of appropriateness of certain forms for certain things, not all of which I agreed with, but it was a great education. But the way I started teaching myself to draw and design letters was it was a visionary experience. I just, in November of 1996, I was looking at a drawing and I suddenly had a complete vision for a typeface in my head, which came out of nowhere. I have horrible handwriting. I'm not a good calligrapher or anything like that. And the next morning I got out of bed and literally just considered myself a type designer and started teaching myself to draw letters. And I designed a number of alphabets before I actually made a typeface about 12 years later. And since then I've designed quite a few typefaces, but now it's gotten to the point where when I print, especially because my writing is becoming a much larger part of my work, when I print a book of mine in someone else's typeface, I feel like I'm lying, because I've spent so much time drawing letters with my own voice in mind that when I'm very specifically printing a living poet or someone like that, I can use someone else's typefaces. But so anyway, it's just developed into this very sort of alphabetical prison. Like I can only use my own types, and I'm playing with a little bit now, but
yeah. Yeah. That's really cool. Okay. So let's just go back to chronologically. So you went to Boston and worked at Firefly, and then I know you ended up in New York. I met you when I worked at Dudonet Paper Mill,
right?
And did some work at the Center for Book Arts as well. So, So how did that happen?
I worked at Firefly Press for 8 months. I think he would agree with this, so I don't feel bad about saying it, but the owner, John Christensen, and I really don't get along. I learned so much from him, it was not the right fit. And, so I left there, moved out west. I was involved in a relationship with someone who was having some pretty severe mental issues and needed to go west, and it was sort of the right time for me to leave there. And so we went out to Oregon for a while, and then that ended, and I made my way down to Albuquerque, where I have family, and built a house with my uncle, and then just realized I really wanted to start my own press. And so I moved back in with my parents basically and rented space at the Center for Book Arts. So that was in 1993.
Okay.
And then I printed and published at the Center for Book Arts, which at the time was great because it was just a few blocks away from Dudenay Paper Mill, which at that time I was doing a lot of work with. Dudenay was making a lot of paper for my books, and I was also getting this education. And you know, there was Dudenay on one side and New York Central on the other, and just getting this great paper education. And then when the Center for Book Arts moved from Lower Broadway in 1999, they mismanaged the move so dramatically that they had to close for 6 months just to unpack the boxes. Mm. And that was what first got me to set up my own studio. And so I rented a place and bought a little press and which I then just moved around for quite a long time before finally finding my current studio. But I'm really indebted to the Center for Book Arts. It was such a great, you know, $250 a month, which I rarely paid, and you had 24-hour access, and it was a great place to start a press. But
so you rarely paid just because that's kind of how you are.
I pay my bills now. Okay. and I give money to the Center for Book Arts as a sort of penance.
Oh, okay.
Because I also met my wife there, and there's a lot that the center has given me. But I just couldn't manage anything. I didn't pay my electric bill. I didn't pay any, you know, I mm-hmm. just and so at one point they just made me the artist in residence. I think partly because they were like, well, he never pays anyway, so let's just take away the need to pay. And uh-huh. I was there. But then eventually, you know, toward the late 90s, I started figuring out how to live financially a bit better. So I started paying my rent at the end, but there were a number of years there where.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me how you got into publishing. You published 60 books now. You have a checklist on your website. Yeah. And I have several questions in my head. Working on handmade paper, you mentioned Dudenay and starting to right. do that. And what was maybe one project you can describe that?
I'll just say that for me, the printing has always been about making books. Mm-hmm. I have spent a number of years doing job printing, and they were miserable for me. Mm-hmm. I know a lot mm-hmm. of people get great satisfaction out of doing that kind of work, but for me, it was always about the book. I sort of studied in San Francisco, where there, you know, there were still the remnants of the California fine press tradition, where there was lots of, you know, handmade paper was the thing, you know. And then coming to New York, I then got exposed to Dudenay, which at that time was transitioning from doing more production papermaking into more artistic mm-hmm. work. It sort of brought this new level of understanding of what paper could do. And so there was one book that was sort of my first sort of big project, was a collaboration with Dudenay. It was a book called Elements, where there were five boxes, one a poem by Robert Bringhurst, and four boxes were each contained five images about the one of the four elements. And and I worked very closely with Mina and Paul and Sharon Durr at the time to develop different papers for each of those elements. So for air, even though the name sounds wrong, for instance, the images, I cut the images as watermarks, so you needed light to see the images. Mm-hmm. And then for water, we made this, well, not we, they Paul made this paper out of pure silk that he dried on metal sheets, so it was just smooth, incredibly smooth, and I printed the images in sort of translucent ink to so that they were like water stains. For Earth, we did this Belgian linen paper that was really thick, and I cut the sort of neoprene images that were then pressed into the paper, so it was really thick and earthy. And then cotton abaca paper for fire, which I then branded with the images. And then just an, I think it was just an abaca paper for the text. And that was sort of, you know, before I started designing letters to sort of to convey content. At that time, I was very much into using material to try to convey content and material and process. And that book was really just a huge leap for me from making small projects to really working on a larger scale. And
was that an edition or one of a kind?
That was we did 25 copies, and I made all the boxes. So the fire box was I made out of copper and then patinated it, and then the earth box was made of wood, and all the rest were made of covered in different Japanese silks. And and we had an exhibit at Dudene in which I built a wall with light boxes in it for the so you could see the watermarks, and it was a really big event for me.
I remember that. I was there, and I think you printed a publication in relationship to it, maybe too, or maybe that was
I printed some sort of fairly elaborate prospectus, I think. Okay. About it, but okay. But that was it was a collaboration with a Norwegian artist, and we made 25, but half the books went to Norway, and who knows what happened to them. I don't have a complete copy, unfortunately, but the
Cool. Okay, so tell me, so you said around 1999 you you're in the same studio, or you moved around, and now
you've moved a lot.
Go ahead. Okay. Yeah, so you moved several times, but what's your studio today, and how long have you been there?
So today I'm in my 10th year of a 15-year lease in a laboratory. I rent a laboratory in the abandoned Pfizer building in Brooklyn on Flushing Avenue, and it's just completely different than any other. You know, every other studio I've had, I've had to like hang Vandercooks from the tops of elevators to get them into spaces and do all kinds of things. And this has a 8 feet out my door has a 16,000-pound freight elevator with 8 loading docks, and it's a really different kind of space. It's well ventilated. I don't use any natural light in my space. So I have an interior space with no windows. And so it's just this sort of perfect place for me where they somehow managed to give me this long lease. But before that, I think in the 10 years prior to that, I had moved my studio 11 times. This is a big difference. So now I went from having a very pared down, movable studio to just this enormous amount of just equipment and metal, and moving is going to be a nightmare when it inevitably has to happen. I went from that one press to now I have 4 presses and an etching press and a number of other cutters and things like that. Yeah.
Right.
And wow. Two of your restraint drying systems that you designed. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We reconnected over that several years ago. Yeah. That was cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to hear a little bit more about the type and just the process of using getting your type manufactured. You know, people maybe don't know about metal type, and then using it on handmade paper and other paper if you use it on other paper. Just
yeah sure. I mean, you know, I just because I try to design a typeface for each book, I can't make all, you know, I've made 4 metal typefaces, 3 of which are just capital letters, you know, titling faces. One has upper and lower case, but most of my type I print from photopolymer plates because it's such an endeavor to make a metal type that it's not practical. But but I am now just, in fact, this afternoon, I'm having the first real meeting about making the next one, which will be upper and lowercase Roman and italics. So it will finally be a complete face with which I can set complex material, which is, but I've made type with a bunch of different, but basically anyone who would make type with me. And but the person I work with most is a man named Ed Rayer, who has Swamp Press and Letter Foundry in Massachusetts. And he has one of the Betton engravers that came out of the American Type Founders auction when American Type Founders closed down. There were a number of engravers that they had, and he has one of them and knows how to use it, which is critical.
Yeah.
And he and I have just, you know, I think the first time he cast type for me was in 1994 or something like that. And I had been working with the Dale Guild on some type projects, and that sort of fell apart. The Dale Guild got broken up and it caused me to get reconnected with Ed because I had heard he was making type, and we have this wonderful working relationship. I design all the, well, I do some preliminary drawing for some of the alphabets with pencil, but I do the actual drawings in Adobe Illustrator and then I make them into digital typefaces using FontLab, so I can figure out all of the, you know, the most critical thing with, well, one of the most critical things with the type design is how much space is on either side of a letter, so that when they fit well together and the rhythm when set into words is one that is attractive in one way or another to the eye. And so I do all of that. I figure that out digitally. And then I give my digital file to Ed, and then we work on trials of sort of figuring out how to convert that digital image into metal pieces that will work well together. So right now the typeface that we're working on has some issues that in digital space are not a problem, but in analog metal space are. So the type fit well together in metal, whereas it does in digital because there is no there. And so it becomes this collaborative process of having to, you know, just like with anything in our field, having to, you know, work, design and conceive toward the technology that you're using, you know, and in that process, seeing if you can push it a little bit one way or another. But you know, it takes years. Like the type that I finished with the type archive in London, which is called Hungry Dutch, and it's the one that is upper and lowercase. I mean, it took 5.5 years to make, you know, and because no one can work on this full time. No, there's, you know, there's not the money to just say, okay, take you know, 3 months off and just work on my project, you know. And so I think with Ed, with this new type, there are over 200 matrices that need to be engraved. So it'll be a number of years, you know, before it's done, if it, assuming it gets done. I approach all of the type projects with the caveat that there's a good chance they won't be completed, just because, you know, it's
right. But you have a particular book in mind that you will print with it?
Well, this is this type is the reason that I'm committing to making this one into metal is, you know, as someone who's self-taught, I did what a lot of self-taught people do, which is I started by imitating alphabets that I liked, by redrawing historical alphabets that I liked, and mm-hmm. and sort of learning from previous masters how to do things. And and over the years, well, over the decades at this point, I've slowly developed what I think of as my own alphabetical voice. And so this is the first alphabet, well, typeface that I designed specifically for printing my voice. And as writing is becoming so much more prominent in my work, I felt like this was the type to make. If I was going to make a big investment in a new type, that this was the one to make. And in contrast to my previous type design, it's not for a specific book, it's for a specific voice.
Okay.
Which is my voice. So the Hungry Dutch typeface, for instance, was designed for my book Hungry Bibliophiles originally, printed from polymer. But then when making it with the type archive, I chose it specifically because the type archive is the remnants of the Monotype Corporation. And a lot of my issues with the types that are available to us as printers are with the Monotype Corporation. I don't agree with their aesthetic choices in many instances. And so with that project, I chose Hungry Dutch specifically because it was the least monotype of my type designs. As the head of drawings said, when I first showed him the type, he said that monotype would have rejected every one of the letters. And that was my acknowledgement that it was the right type to make,
right,
to see if, you know, see if it was, I wanted to know if monotype faces looked the way they did because the machines had to make things that way, or because it was an aesthetic choice by the engineers. And it was definitely the latter of the
right.
two. So that was sort of like making a metal type as an intellectual exercise.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to let you know that my new book, The Art of Papercraft, is now out in the world. The book offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can order that directly from me at HelenHebertStudio.com. And if the autograph doesn't matter to you, the book is available wherever fine books are sold. It's also available on Kindle. And by the way, my book, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, has also just been released on Kindle. And my other papermaking book, The Papermaker's Companion, has been available on Kindle for a couple of years. Now back to our conversation.
You mentioned Hungry Bibliophiles. Let's go back to some paper stories. Like, when did you start ordering large amounts of handmade paper from different mills? Because I know you've worked with many.
Yeah. Slowly as I figured out how to, as I I guess as my career grew, I was able to invest in bigger projects. You know, it's very hard to, when you're starting out, to say, I'm going to spend 2 years working on something, you know, and hope that someone will buy it. You need to establish a collecting base that will sort of support you through that project. And so what started with Dudene of getting like 50 sheets of paper or 100 sheets of paper slowly in 2010 led me to order 3,000 sheets of paper from the Velká Lázeň mill in the Czech Republic. And that was by far the largest handmade paper order to that date that I had made. And I was really just entranced by the idea that I could get this paper, very attractive paper, handmade paper with two custom watermarks in it for $2.71 a sheet. And that led me, the prices are quite different now, but the that led me to overlook some of the, I had taken a couple of sheets to do some testing, and but I was so determined to buy the paper that even though the tests showed me that there were some issues with this paper, I ordered it anyway. And
how did you find them? And you didn't go there. This was all.
No, I didn't go there. Yeah. So they are represented in the United States by Atlantic Paper, by Pavel Rapinski. And he came to the Codex Book Fair, you know, you know, envelopes of samples. And I, you know, struck up a conversation with him, and I had had this. I had ordered some paper for the book from another maker who I just because I shouldn't mention just didn't work out at all. Mm-hmm. And so Pavel walked by and said, hey, I can have this for you. It's inexpensive. We can do watermarks and everything. It just felt like the perfect situation, and it was going to be a really, this was going to be a really big book for me, and so it felt like, well, this is, you know, it should be on handmade paper, and it should be anyway. So I get this paper, and the books that it was for is called Specimens of Diverse Characters, and in it there's an enormous amount of incredibly precise registration, which means that you can't print damp, because the no matter what you do, the registration tolerance was a quarter of a point, so 1/288th of an inch, and there's no way you could control the humidity on that paper through seven colors to be able to register it. It was just no way. So I had to print it dry, and when I got it, it was this beautifully sized paper that when I printed my fine lines and fine type, they suddenly looked much darker, and the paper wasn't absorbing the ink. There was so much surface sizing on the paper that it just wasn't, everything looked terrible. The solids looked great. Really, it printed beautifully for color solids, and it was this white paper that really, there was a lot of color printing in the book, and the colors just sort of were luminous on the page. So it was a beautiful paper, but the problem was is that the fine lines weren't working, so I got to work, and I said, well, there are a couple of pages I can print damp, so I'll dampen it. And I used this dampening method that you know I had heard of in California, that you know you take one sheet and pull it through a bath of water, and then put five dry sheets on and repeat, and then wrap it in plastic and put weight on it overnight, and the next day you have this beautiful
evenly damp paper.
Mm-hmm. Evenly damp paper. And but what in fact that you have, the weight is part of the problem, it turns out. By putting the weight on it, it forces the moisture isn't able to disperse evenly. And what I got the next day, instead of this beautiful, relaxed pile of paper, was a pile of paper that looked like corrugated tin. It was just rippled and crazy. And so anyway, it turned into just this ridiculous effort of, I think we spent 500 hours that summer dampening and drying the paper in order to print it. And what was worse was that I printed one of, it had two etchings in it, and which required dampening the paper twice, once for printing, and then after it dried, once for getting it flat again. And at a certain point after doing that, I realized that the paper really took on the quality I wanted after being dampened and dried twice. So we did that with 3,000 sheets of paper, and we tried all kinds of, and I had this tiny studio that was about 200 square feet, and I built, my assistant Nancy Lober and I built these basswood drying racks with twine, and to make loft drying racks that we could then just pick up and put on tables or put on the guillotine or put on, you know, so that we, so there was room to move, you know, there, right. It was crazy. It was so hot. It was just awful. And, but in the end, I got exactly what I wanted. Like I can't really blame, I can't at all blame the paper. It was that I didn't know what I was doing, really. And which ended up leading to, you know, that was 2011 that I did that printing. It's 2022 now. So for 11 years, I just published a zine about dampening and drying paper that, you know, I've been questioning people ever since then about both sizing and dampening and drying. And you know, it took me, it was 30 years of printing before I developed a technique that really worked for me. Because mostly I didn't print damp, you know, but now I do pretty much all the time when using handmade paper. And,
tell me, you mentioned 7 press runs. You're using an etching press and a letter press. Do you use the same press? Just a little bit about, like,
so that book had 2 single color etchings in it.
Okay.
And the, and at the time for about 5 years, I was really working with this kind of overlay printing from photopolymer plates that I worked on in 3 large scale books, so Ethelwald, etc., Specimens of Diverse Characters, and then my Euclid book, which is called Interstices and Intersections. And I was trying to make images that were somewhat painterly, using the computer and polymer plates. And so there were pages that I think in Specimens, the most press runs on a page was 7 or 8, but by the time I got to Euclid, there was one sheet went through the press 19 times. And and that was also the sign to me that was enough. Like I couldn't take that process any further, and I've since sort of abandoned that. I'm still working with color, but just in different ways now.
Right. Okay. And tell me what the edition size of Specimens was. And then you mentioned Codex, and I know your books are all over the world. Like, what kind of collectors you have? What kind of marketing you do?
Yeah. Okay. The with Specimens, there were I think there were 70 copies in total. There were 50 standard copies. They were all printed on the same paper, but there were 20 deluxe copies that came that had a full leather binding, came with some progressive proofs of some of the images, and then the box, the Specimens was the first book that I made metal type for. And I made two of my four metal typefaces for just to print two pages of that book. And so the box of the deluxe copy has a form of the actual metal type in it. So it's this gigantic, extremely heavy thing. But it, you know, it's sort of a, I guess, a meta experience of ever since Facebook, I hate using that word, but the and the way I've found now that my sort of ideal edition size is about 75. And the way I market my books is by exhibiting at book fair. Well, that's the primary way. I sell my books to dealers who mark, you know, give me publicity and sell my books. And then, but primarily in the current world of book arts and fine press printing, collectors generally like to buy from the producer. And so I exhibit at Codex Book Fair and a couple of other book fairs. And the collectors are sort of, I think I'm still slightly more than half institutional, like mainly small liberal arts colleges that use artist books in their curricula. But more and more through the book fairs, I'm meeting individual collectors who, so they're sort of the growing concern. And then as a way of sort of financing the projects, I offer standing orders. So the subscribers can place a standing order in which they agree to buy one copy of every book in exchange for a 25% discount, or at least a 20, they often get bigger discounts. And that is really the mechanism that allows me to make larger scale projects, because I have this group of people for whom I can, you know, from whom I can request a deposit to pay for materials, and that I know at the end of the project I have sales waiting, you know, that
and the book, right.
Yeah.
Because I did the math in my head for your Specimens book, the paper itself was over $9,000, something like that.
Yeah.
Or about $9,000. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I mean, the binding is always the most expensive part.
And you hire out for that?
I do. Yeah. And I've worked with a number of binders. Now I work with Amy Barrezzo of Shelter Book Works. She's also a book artist and a remarkably talented edition binder, and we've developed a very good relationship of collaborative relationship, and so yeah, the binding is the real killer on the big books, but you know, it's critical, so it's not right. You know, I'm complaining, it's just that's all assuming that I don't pay myself, you know, so we don't count my hours at all. If we did, then I guess I would be the most expensive part, but we never look at those. We never try to figure that out, because it would be too depressing.
I get that. Yeah. Okay. So I just want to touch, let's do as quick as we can, Hungry Bibliophiles.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So when after I made Specimens and had that issue with the sizing on the Velka Lozny, I just happened to be visiting the University of Iowa, and I had never met Tim Barrett before, but he picked me up to take me out to the Oak, I think it's called the Oakdale paper facility out there. And I had no idea how indecising he was. And I got in his car with Annie, my wife Annie, and I said, you know, it's interesting. I've been having this issue with sizing. And the conversation ended 6 hours later or something. And then Tim had this, you know, when he speaks, he often talks about how he would like his paper to be used in the way that early book papers were used. And by that, he means not so preciously, like people would be willing to dog ear the page, write in the margins, you know, but instead it's Tim Barrett's paper. So everybody treats it like it's, you know, the golden egg or something like that. And I was intrigued by this idea, and I realized one day that the only way to get people to actually do that was to come up with a book whose content provoked them to treat the book that way, and that the only book I could think of was a cookbook. And so what I did is I invited 20 or 25 bibliophiles to submit recipes for a meal. And in exchange, they would get a copy of the book and agree to try to cook every recipe in the book with the book on their counter while they were cooking, and to take notes in ink in the margins about the recipes. And then at the end, when everyone was done, I got all the books back and selected pages and then made a facsimile of the used books where you saw the where you got all the content, but then you also got the marginalia, a selection of the marginalia. But this book was, so that was one part of it, to try to test, you know, to try to get people to use Tim's paper the way he wanted it used. But the other part was to try to also engage with one of his other theories and one of the issues I had with specimens, which he believes that around 1500, printers started getting waterleaf paper from paper makers, meaning unsized paper, printing on it. And then someone, either the printer or the binder, would size the paper before binding. And because sizing is critical for marginalia, it prevents the absorption of liquid ink, but it also prevents the absorption of printing ink, which has a negative impact.
Right. Well, and let's just mention that people, when handmade paper was the only paper, people right. wrote in their books.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at 16th century books, they're full of annotations right. and cross outs and little, you know, and that's the kind of book that really Tim and I both love paging through those books. And yeah. so there was, but so what we did with Hungry Bibliophiles is he sent me unsized paper. I printed on it. And as I printed it, I sent it back and it was sized afterward. And then I drove the last sheets out and sized the remaining sheets with him in Iowa. And it was fascinating because the function of sizing is not only, I mean, most of your audience would know this better than I would, but it is not just to allow you to write on a paper or do watercolor or whatever, but it imparts an enormous amount of strength to the paper. And so we did, Tim has this amazing little machine, folding machine, where you put a kilogram of weight and you just fold, it just folds the paper back and forth. And the unsized chancery paper that we used broke at 300 folds, and the sized paper broke at 1500 folds. So five times stronger. And to give you an idea, Mohawk Superfine breaks at 35 folds.
Wow.
And the U.S. currency is something like 10,000 or 20,000. So, you know, and so these books are indestructible. You know, I have a poorly bound copy of Hungry Bibliophiles in my studio that every once in a while I just smash into the table just to see if it will damage it. And it doesn't at all. It's so that was the project. And
right. And what do you remember the recipe of the paper, the fibers in it?
It was a 2080, but I don't remember what was the 20 and what was the 80.
Well, I'll just mention to listeners that Russell wrote an article for Hand Paper Making magazine. I'll mention it in the show notes, and it has your whole process stepped right. out of the way and you dried the paper and all that. And then some, a sample of, the sized and unsized. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And the Chancery paper he mentioned, there's also information I'll link to about Tim Barrett's project about making 100 sheets an hour, 2,000 a day. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
And that paper is now gone, you know, no longer being made, unfortunately, but I've got a nice stash of it. So,
cool. Well, what are you working on now? And you mentioned a couple times that you're writing more, and you're really a great writer. Just, I hear how you're thinking about things just on little blog posts or in the, I have a copy of your latest zine. What's the last part called? The whatever, where you wrote your thoughts. I can't remember the name of that.
The afterword.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So what's coming down the pike, or what are you working on right now?
Well, strangely, after talking about all this writing, the project I'm working on right now is in the pandemic, I made a lot of work and it was all black ink, pretty much almost all black ink. And I like black ink as much as the next printer, but what I really love is color. And so I've been feeling, like I'm deprived of sunshine or something. And so I'm printing an excerpt from Goethe's theory of colors called Colored Objects. And it's a very different project for me, where I'm only working 2 days a week in the studio on it. And I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's really, I'm trying to encourage that. I want to do something different. And my books differ quite a bit from one to the next. And so I don't think that my work is formulaic, but it's a huge fear of mine. I don't want to make the same thing over again. And so I've been feeling a little stilted in the black type on white paper world, and I want to break out of that a bit. So it's really just an opportunity to experiment with different ways of getting color onto paper, and using printing, etching and letterpress. But it's in the very early stages. The book artist Emily Martin is staying with me right now, and she's very well-versed in movable books, and I think there are going to be some movable aspects to it, which I've never had in my work before. And so she's coming to the studio tomorrow, and we're going to workshop some things. But it's really it's a kind of scary, but it's really nice to be able to say that I don't know what I'm doing at the moment, because I've, like you say, I've published 60 books, and so it's like there's always something next, and I know what it is, and I'm trying to break that up a little bit. And then on the side, in the other times, I'm doing some writing that at this point is not intended for a book for me to publish, but for someone else to publish. But it's too embryonic to really talk about at the moment. So, messing around and trying to get lost is what I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah. I can totally relate to that. The fear, but excitement too. And
right.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. And I asked you about some recommendations and I loved your response. So, let's talk about, you talked about building relationships with paper makers and paper suppliers.
Right. Yeah. It's critical. I mean, it's such a small world, this field, that you can get to know everybody, you know, I met Mina Takahashi in 1990, you know, and by 1995, Dudonné was making paper for me, for a couple of years, pretty regularly. Through that, I got to know Sue Gosin, and these people are still very much part of my work, even though neither of them are making paper for me. But as part of the Hungry Bibliophiles process, I wanted to see if I could develop a paper that, through using fiber combinations and different beading lengths, would imitate the qualities of sizing without having any sizing in it. And so as part of that, I went to visit Mina on her farm where she lived at the time. And we did a bunch of samples, which I then took with my longest papermaking relationship is with Travis Becker at Twin Rocker. And so for the deluxe copies of my Euclid book, he and I worked to develop a paper that was a cotton paper that cotton half stuffs paper that I don't remember the quantity, but a certain amount of fairly highly beaten abaca, we were able to get a paper that that did everything sized paper does. Mm-hmm. It's extremely strong. And as an example of that, I was printing this standard copies on Zirkel paper. And on the and for that, I was doing a lot of that overlay printing. And on the Zirkel paper, I would be able to print wet on wet. So I could print 9 colors right on top of each other. But the handmade paper that was acting like it was sized, because the paper wouldn't absorb the same way, when I would print the second color, rather than the second color going onto it, it would peel the ink off the paper that I had printed previously.
Yeah.
And that really showed me that it was, so I had to completely change the way I approached the printing. And, we really were able to get a paper that acted as if it was, it's only through, you know, I can call Travis up and say, hey, I've got this crazy thing. And that, you know, he's an open kind of person. I'm sure he would be open with anyone, but there's something about the nurturing of that relationship. And then with other people, you know, when New York Central closed down, I had been buying paper from them and from David Aldera, the manager, for I forget how long it was, but 20 years probably. And when they first closed down, he called, I don't know how many of us he called, but he said, come in and take your pick, you know, and get it while you can. And, you know, we had to pay, but all of these papers that he had been hoarding were suddenly available and they're now mine. And, and a couple of years ago, a book dealer called me up and said, you know, I've got a ream of Crown and Scepter paper that's 100 years old. Do you want this? And, you know, and, um, And so, you know, it's the networking and working with the same people over long periods of times, really, you know, it doesn't necessarily start out feeling collaborative. It's like a transactional experience, but over time, it adds so much to it. It has added so much to my work, at least. And so, yeah. And, you know, I just ordered a bunch of Velka Lozny paper because now I know how to, how to handle, you know, and with all the commercial mills closing down or whatever, it's really, you know, we're really having to go back to using handmade paper more, I think. And, which to me is great, but, yeah. So I think the, you know, I mean, you, like, we met in the 90s sometime, mid 90s, and we, you know, we don't see much of each other, but, you know, it's like you wrote me a few years ago saying you were going to Holland, and I, you know, I was able to give you some places to see, and, you know, using
some
your
books,
and using your resources on your on your website is like really helped me in my work. So it's
there's a lot to say about I guess consistency is a little bit in the paper, you know, you have the relationship and you know what the baseline, and then you can kind of change things. And then I agree, keeping in touch with people is important as well, the relationships. Well, Russell, it's been a treat. Where can we find you online?
RussellMarette.com. So it's RussellMarette.com. And and there's I've been pretty bad about my blog lately, but the I have in the past kept a pretty elaborate blog, which is linkable through there. And with the new project, because it's so amorphous and there's so much process, I plan on blogging regularly again about this new Goethe project. So there'll be stuff coming out soon.
Yeah. So listeners, I will link to some of the things we talked about and some of your blog posts as well. Right. Yeah. So thanks all for chatting with me, Russell.
Thanks so much, Helen. It's been great.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
The main contain